For joining us today. I'm Jean Lunavetter, Director of Schools, and I have been assigned to ask questions today. So the group you see behind or in front of you, I guess, is members of our review committee. We also do have a couple of board members who are joining us just to sit and listen. So we will be asking questions of you. I will ask the questions. We do have committee members assigned, so if you have follow-up or clarification questions, we will then turn it over to that committee member to introduce themselves and identify what position they hold and ask for any clarification. But I'm going to start. I would love if you would each just introduce yourselves. All right, thank you so much. So these questions that we have were just some that came up as we examined the application and just had further questions about. So we are going to start with, you compare your model to two schools with similar curricula in your application, South Bronx Classical and Nashville Classical. However, these schools are independent programs and not affiliated with the Barney Charter School Network, and their curricular materials are explicitly designed to be aligned with the standards for the states in which they are operating. So the first question is, what would you say are the greatest similarities and differences between the model you aim to provide in your school and the two models that you have cited in your application, since they are independent institutions not affiliated with BCSI?
Can you guys hear me? I'm sorry. I think there's more similarities, obviously, in that it's a classical model. So the manner in which we set up, the way that we inform kids and teach them, it would be very similar. So if you start talking about similarities, it's all the structures that make classical schools. So the way that the classrooms are set up as far as the teachers and their instruction, the material that they're teaching, the way that the classrooms and the building is set up, basically the activities that are available to them would be very similar. There's things that we could go through each one of those that I would say would be very similar to those two schools. I would say the focus, obviously, on becoming learned, being able to be reasonably sound and compassionate and good would be very similar. The idea of looking at moral character, this idea of being a good and decent person would be very similar. I think something that we focus on that would be somewhat different, but not altogether different, is that we look at the civic activity of a child. So this idea that they'll be a participant in this American system that we're in, and we want them to be aware of who we are as a people and how they could actively participate. It's a purposeful part of what we do, which I would say is not something I see as explicitly in those works there. But I would say there's definitely a lot more similarities in our curriculum as far as what our expectations about what the graduate would be and what a child learns and how they do that.
How will you aim to provide a curriculum that is rigorously aligned to Tennessee state standards, similar to how these programs have done for both Tennessee and New York?
Well, I think the primary way to do that is that as a system, that we have to have a professional development that has that expectation and a vision that has that expectation. So part of the work that we do at a school level, if I'm the administrator, for example, is that some of the professional development is around how we align what we're teaching to what's going on in the state. So obviously, as a public school, we're going to be tested in this state and have to have children that can find success showing their literacy and their mathematics and any other topic. So the teachers themselves have to have a recognition of what those standards are. So usually throughout the year, especially at the beginning, we look at the curriculum and what we'll be teaching throughout the years, and we look at the standards. Much of this work has been done already. But it's something that you continually do. So as you're assessing children, you're also keeping in mind what the standards of the state are as well.
According to edreports.com, the Singapore math curriculum is not aligned to college and career-ready standards. So how will you ensure your materials are standards aligned, and where are you in that process?
Well, I think that's an ongoing conversation, and it's kind of connected to my last answer. I mean, the idea is that as we do our work, we have to be looking through the standards of the state so that our teachers know what they are aligning some of their work to. The effect that we've had with Singapore math is that While you don't specifically see the alignment, and we'd be aware of that alignment, the kids come out with a strong understanding of the mathematics and show that they know a lot of the ideas that are presented in these assessments. But yeah, I think part of our work as educators is we have to know what the standards are of the state, and the expectation is that conversation with the administrator and teachers and other staff would be ongoing.
In section one of your application, you indicate several times you plan to make use of ability grouping during reading and math blocks to intervene for students who are not on track with classroom instruction. So how will you ensure a balance with this practice so students also continue to receive access to rigorous leveled instruction?
So as the application puts out, I mean, our hope is to keep kids as close to the LRE as possible. I mean, obviously we want students as much as possible to be in what's going on. They need to be around the general instruction. So if that's kind of the view of the school, that we think that the greatest amount of learning happens in that place, you want students to be as close to that as possible. So this becomes an ongoing conversation as well. As you see in the application, these are conversations that we have every week, bi-weekly, monthly, as far as how students are doing. And in those conversations with teachers, special ed teachers, specialists, you know, TAs, teachers assistants, there's this ongoing conversation as to what best benefits the student. And so small groups is part of that conversation. So there's always this opportunity to see how pulling a child in or out of a space can be done well. Obviously, I think the best small groups are done within the larger group. There, of course, are small groups where you can actually take a child out of a classroom into another group as well. But I think the closer they are to what's actually happening in the discussion that's going on, the better for each student. But it's, again, it's an ongoing discussion. I call them student talks in any schools that I've ever run, where you have this ongoing, very tangible, weekly conversation around students and the places where they'll best benefit.
This structure is not in alignment with Tennessee's guidelines for RTI squared implementation. So how will you ensure your practices are aligned with the Tennessee expectations?
So the RTI squared, again, is something that when you start talking about the establishment of a school, it's very important that the people in that school know what that is and how it's expected. You know, so most of us, if you're in public education or education generally, know of RTI and this idea of intervention. But this hope that instruction is constantly taking on the needs of every child needs to be understood by every person in that building. I think it's the administrator's responsibility to make sure that that's happening and making sure that the students are getting the supports that they need in the tier 1, 2, 3 elements and the potential special ed or 504 designation.
How will you ensure that IDEA guidelines are implemented and monitored? What is the plan to handle any compliance concerns regarding IDEA and or Tennessee State Board rules?
To be consistent with what I'm saying, of course, we have to be, the people, the adults that are in that building need to know these things. As an administrator, it's important to keep that conversation. The other thing you see in our application is that you have positions that do that. So you have student service director whose primary job is to make sure that we're doing that and that we're taking care of every child. So as both an administrator and having the personnel there, it's important to keep the teachers and teachers' age and specialists and special ed teachers all informed of what current law is on special ed and as well as 504 law. To me, to be an effective school, especially in the public realm, you have to have adults in that room that know that. And most importantly to me, of course, you need compassionate people that care about the kids and know how to use these policies and laws to their benefit. So again, that's an ongoing. It's not just like a dump at the beginning of the year. I think at the beginning of the year is a good time to set the tone as far as our expectations around those things. But it has to be revisited. I mean, we as adults are much like kids in that we need to be reminded of things over and over and over again. And when it comes to policy, I think it's important to do that.
So the data that you provide to show success of your model is Florida achievement data. However, there is not information provided about student growth within these schools or the student subgroups they serve. Additionally, the ranking system in Florida to determine student proficiency is different than Tennessee. So what growth data do you have for the performance of partner schools as part of your application?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean, I'd have to go through that data a little bit more specifically. When I read through the data, I do see elements of growth that you can compare kind of a cohort to cohort. As far as the explicit piece, some of the subgroups you see in that data, you definitely see the growth that's present there. But part of our work, and that's what's interesting about this, is that we are new to this space as far as our school. And for, as far as Florida, I think we actually are pretty similar to what you see in those spaces as far as achievement. But growth is fundamental to education. I can basically assure you that the growth data that you would see with us would be monitored and reported regularly, not just on an annual basis.
What similar data do you have from other schools in other states that have a similar ranking system to Tennessee's, and how consistent is this performance across network schools?
That's our question. Have you seen the data from all the schools? I mean, my biggest thing that I can attest to, any BCSI school that I've seen, you've seen growth and you've seen significant achievement, and you've seen it with diverse populations. I can't speak to every school in the system, but I can look at some of the macro numbers, and what you see in achievement is similar to the demographics that they serve. So if you go to the 22 other BCSI schools, you'll see that they serve kids of all, I mean, in major urban areas, rural spaces, suburban spaces. And wherever you see these schools, they outperform. And I think that's what you see in the data. In Florida, you see anywhere from 10 to 20 points of increase that's consistent in all the other schools. That's all data that I'm sure we could pull and send to you if you'd like to see the data from the other systems, the other BCSI. So that's something that we could definitely provide. I am aware that we just put Florida in there, but I've been to several of the other BCSI schools and I've seen their data as well. It's consistent, so when you ask about how it is through the network, I don't have any doubt that BCSI schools perform well and they take care of the literacy and the numeracy needs and other needs of students as well.
You have several Tennessee perspectives represented on the ACE board. However, according to your bylaws, there is no guarantee those positions will continue to be filled with local perspectives. Moreover, while there is a board member who works in Montgomery County, he does not reside in the community, leaving our county the only one of the five that you aim to serve without local representation. So what is your plan to ensure the parents and community members of Montgomery County have sufficient representation in your decision-making throughout the life of your organization?
I'm happy to take that one. So the goal from an ACE perspective and from a board perspective is to ensure that we do have representation from each of the communities that we're serving on the board and as a member of that board. As is noted, our bylaws don't require that, and our bylaws don't require that that individual is specifically within the county. We were very happy to have Dr. Dennis Pearson, who is a professor here, obviously locally on the board, and believe that his position as an educator and as a member of the academic community of Parksville Montgomery makes him uniquely suited to serve that position versus someone who may specifically reside in the county. However, if you know, we do expect that there will be turnover on the board. These are not lifetime appointments, obviously. And so as we seek to fill that board and maintain that goal of having local representation, there'll be opportunities, especially if CMCSS believes that physically residing in the community versus working full-time in the community is the appropriate requirement, to discuss that and make sure that that's something we could solve.
Based on the fact that your letters of support are primarily form letters with identifying information removed, we cannot verify how many of them express support from parents of students in our community. What is a figure that you can provide at this point that represents the interest you have from parents of school-aged children in the community?
So I think, as is noted in the application, we'd be happy to provide a physical copy of those letters of support that have not been redacted. Unfortunately, last year, and it's not due to CMCSS, some of the letters of support that were published resulted in people being harassed, and so we wanted to respect folks' privacy. However, we're happy to provide that to this committee if you guys would like to see it. On top of that, I think we're extremely confident, given the feedback we've had from the community about our ability to fill 340 seats upon opening in the K through 5 model. Through the parent information meetings we've had here, through the outreach and network of people like Jackie in this community, I don't think that our belief is that 340, which represent less than 1% of the CMCSS population, especially when you factor in our expectation of a number of homeschooling students in the county who would not currently be part of CMCSS enrolling in the school, we project that to be anywhere from 20 to 30%, that we will not have any issue, again, filling those seats within the school.
Since you will be staffing a statewide organization with primarily two people, it will perhaps be a challenge to ensure that school leaders receive the support they need, and you discuss the role of the local advisory committee in filling this gap. However, that group is not highlighted on your organizational chart, and it's not entirely clear what the relationship is for that group to other entities in your organization. So what is the relationship to the administrator, to the board, and how will that group be held accountable to conduct themselves ethically similar to your board? And will they be subject to any governance structures, bylaws, code of ethics, et cetera?
Yeah, I can take that. So to take that question in two parts, the former question around school leaders receiving the support that they need, the model that we have proposed at ACE is obviously predicated on having each of these schools be as local and as independent as possible. However, we recognize that myself and Phil here can be valuable resources to work with the head of schools, the lead administrators within these organizations, and that's what's detailed in the application. So we feel that there will be more than sufficient support, and I believe the application also notes that ACE would consider hiring additional staff as necessary if further support is required. In terms of the local advisory committee, this is something that we call out specifically will be formed at each school location. The purpose of that community, and I'll have Phil talk a little bit around how that works in practice, but the purpose of that is to ensure, of course, that there is a feedback loop between parents whose children are at the school and the administration of the school. I think that's incredibly important. However, that committee does not have governance responsibilities for the school, and the governance responsibilities lie with the ACE board, which is detailed in the application. But there is a lot of value we have found in having that local advisory committee and having that continuous conversation with parents of that community. Bill, do you want to talk about how that works in practice?
Sure. So having run these schools, and that was what was interesting to me about the way that the question was said. So we obviously have a board that makes sure that we're abiding by legal and formal policy and structures. I mean, that's there. The way that schools often work that are independent charter schools is that the head of the school in many ways takes on several roles, meaning when it comes to how the school runs, they're having to make decisions that aren't uniquely that of a principal, for example. They're having to make some larger system decisions that are in a conversation with the board. So for me, and it feels that way. I mean, having worked in larger districts in LA and Cleveland, you feel the responsibility differently than when you're a principal in a large structure, because you're having to abide by larger legal structures that you need to be making sure that you're getting the right information about. And so boards play that role to make sure that we're crossing the T's and dotting the I's. But as far as the ability to move within the building, there's just a lot more independence. So what ends up happening is that the principal needs to ensure not only that they're getting the support from a board, but that they have a team around them that can do all these various things in a way that a school works. And some of that might bleed outside of the responsibilities that a principal might have in a regular school in a larger district. So the way that it feels is the principal in many ways feels like, much like what a superintendent might feel, having to take care of an entire district. So you're having to take care of all the ins and outs and making sure that the board is aware of what's going on in the school. Obviously, as a community school, you have a much, every charter school I've been in either California, Ohio, or hopefully here, you see a significant participation by parents. And so parents play a major role in what's going on and making sure that we're aware of what's going on in the local community as well. That's what it feels like locally. Of course, we're a public structure, so it's very important that we abide by the laws and the policy of the local governments and the state governments as well.
Your enrollment projections indicate that you intend for your school demographics to include 40% students of color, 50% students from low economic backgrounds, 15% students with disabilities, and 5% English learners. However, the locations you cite that are being considered are in areas of the county where many of these populations have low levels of representation, and there is not ready access to public transportation. What is your concrete plan to ensure that all students in Montgomery County could access your school to include contingencies for transportation?
Great question. So, I may jump ahead and combine some of the questions on the update on the facility search. So as was noted in the application, there were a number of sites that we've looked at in the community. We continued to work over the past year with Mark Holloman, local real estate agent. We have several locations, some which are very urban, so downtown Clarksville, in addition to the greenfield sites we provided and the renderings. That search continues. I will admit that we have found it difficult to have property owners commit to an LOI given the delay here locally, and so the vacillation around an authorization decision. However, our expectation is if we were to be authorized, we would be able to move quickly on several properties that remain on the market. So now dovetailing that with transportation, as the application also says, currently we don't have a plan to provide full transportation for the school. However, our goal and our mandate is to ensure that any student within the community who wants to attend the school, if it were authorized, will be able to do so. You can see that in the fact that we've budgeted for transportation dollars within the budget in a pretty significant amount. We may or may not have to use those dollars depending on who enrolls on the school and where the primary location is. The demographic breakdown of the school is intended to mimic or be identical to the overall demographic compositions of CMCSS. That is our expectation and our goal. We are aware that location can play a role in that, but that is the goal we will be trying to achieve. Again, referring to an earlier part of this conversation, I'd say the conversations we're having with parents in the community have given us further belief that that demographic makeup is likely to be achieved within the school, given the interest from the various subpopulations in this option. And Jackie could talk a little bit around some of those outreach and the ways we're doing that. The fact that we have community engagement materials in multiple languages that we've handed out. This is our goal. This is what we aspire to. And again, our commitment is to make sure that any student who wants to attend the school will be able to do so. Looking at ridership rates of bus transportation, of local transportation, and I don't have that number obviously for CMCSS, but knowing that in Tennessee, ridership now is averaging only 60%, our expectation is that some parents will be willing to drive their students, or would prefer to drive their students to the school. So we don't expect a situation, if that average holds true, we don't expect a situation where we would need to provide transportation to 100% of the students, given that that's not the rate that I'm sure CMCSS currently sees, nor is it the rate that is the average now in Tennessee, especially post-COVID. So again, what I'd say here is it's our goal to make sure that any student who wants to attend can do so, regardless of where the location is. Our commitment and our goal is to have that location be as central as possible to ensure that any student within the county who chooses and desires to attend the school, or their parents support that, that we'll be able to support that decision and have them enroll.
I wasn't sure he'd referenced.
Oh, yeah, Jackie, do you want to talk a little bit around your some of the ways that we're interacting from a community engagement perspective?
It's one of the things I love, is absolutely engaging parents and helping them understand that we have a brand new, exciting option that would be coming to your area and to this community and to the other communities. And we do that in various ways. We have gone as far as having billboards out on major thoroughfares where people can see a number and call to find out information about that. We also want to entertain the ideas of radio ads, the hip-hop stations where our parents listen to radio, or the top 40 stations, and a lot of faith radio, a lot of parents listen to those. We would buy ads and on those stations. Social media is big for parents, texting messages to parents. They like to get those on their phones. It's immediate for them, they can answer right then. We'll look into that. But my old-fashioned way of just getting out, beating the pavement, meeting people at locations like grocery stores and laundromats and churches. We have a plan to outreach to churches, do a whole tour of churches where we just go to pastors, speak to them about the new options that could be coming to town, and then meeting with parents at the church or even leaving information at churches is a great thing. Libraries is also something we like to access because our education is very closely aligned with literacy. So the libraries are just an absolute, it's a marriage. It's a great place for them to go. And it reminds me of a parent. I was at the Dollar Tree handing out some of my flyers, and there was a mom that was thrilled about the opportunity of having another option for her son. And we find that about parents. They just want to know what's available for their children. This is public education. It's a perfect fit for them. And so those are just some of the things that we have done in the past to outreach parents.
Thank you. You highlight in your, how would you provide an alternative school option if needed? I know your application indicates that you could use the district alternative school, but quite frankly, we have no capacity to support that. So is there a backup plan?
Could you explain what you mean by alternative?
So if there's a disciplinary issue and you would need to send that child off site, what's the backup plan?
Well, I think that the way that I would answer that question is our hope is that this group would approve us to be in your LEA. And so part of that is a partnership. And that's my hope and expectation. Meaning this would be an ongoing conversation that the district would have with our school. We don't see ourselves entirely separate from you. In fact, we'd like to work with you. When it comes to students with significant behavioral issues, that's a conversation that I think we as a district would have to have. Obviously, a small independent charter school would struggle with that child. That's a unique child, a child that has to be displaced from the regular school to go to some other place. Obviously, we would have to have exhausted everything that we could do. I mean, I would start with, some of the students that you're talking about are some of my favorite students, so they are, frankly. we will have exhausted anything that we could do. So part of what I would need to do is have a conversation with you as far as what alternative sites exist in the Clarksville area and what are the best areas for this person. That's always the conversation around the child. I mean, you always are talking about the educators, you're talking to the parents, you're talking about systems and the best placement of these schools. Charter schools themselves don't generally have an alternative school that they send their child to. Obviously, in a smaller school, that would be kind of strange because you might literally have three kids in a school. That's a separate site. The advantage of being in an area like Clarksville is that you can have a conversation with the local district with a group of people that care about the kids here, and that's all we're trying to do with an option. And come to your, hey, we have this child that we've done X, Y, Z, R, A, B, T, S. We've done all these things, and this kid is struggling behaviorally in our space. Do you guys have any thoughts? And what have you guys been doing at Clarksville with a student that has these struggles? I think what you're, to me, that question really is why it's so important that we have this partnership. It's meant to be a partnership. I don't see our school as us versus you. It's not at all. In fact, we have the same students, we're with the same community. There are resources for that type of a child, and my hope would be, like, if I was at the head of a school and that was the situation and I'd exhausted all that we could do, then it's important to come to you. To be frank, I've had that same conversation being in districts. As a principal of major schools in Cleveland or in LA, I mean, there's always that kid that, this isn't working, we need to figure this out. And how do we do this? Because we care about this kid, and we need to make sure that happens. So when you start talking about alternative sites, I think that's a larger conversation that we'd have to have as a community. Having spoken with this child, with the educators, with the parents, hopefully, and with you guys as well, that's how that would be addressed.
Can I just add a quick thought there? So from a legal perspective, when a child is expelled from any school in the district, whether it's district operated or a charter school, that child is now part of the district as a whole. And so in communities where there already are charter schools and there's an alternative school, that's something that they have to figure out together. And so that child, just in the same way that a child that decides to transfer from a charter school is now one of the students in the community and is eligible to transfer as any other child, regardless of what school, public school they've come from. And so we'd be happy to work with you all and work with other districts that figured this out, to figure out what's the notice requirements you all need, to make sure that's there. And then if the alternative school is full, then it's full for any kid. And we would need to figure out, just like any other district operating school, we need to figure out what's the best way to meet this child's needs in that situation.
You highlight in your application that one of the central challenges to opening your school will be finding an effective school leader and one who has a firm understanding of the needs and context of the local community. Can you provide an update on the search for your head of schools, and how will you tap into talent pools for this position?
Yeah, I can take first cut at that. So one benefit to being here back in front of you a year later is that we've had a significant amount of time to work on our head of school pipeline. We have interviewed now, I think, more than 35 individuals who would be potential candidates for head of school. Obviously, we don't have someone who is committed to come here yet because the school is pending authorization. However, we have currently have four individuals who have said they would like to come and join American Classical Education in Tennessee. If schools are authorized. These are folks who are existing principals or head of schools within classical or BCSI school models, so they come with background and experience in this model. They have deep experience of how to implement the school model. Some of them would be new to Tennessee, and so in that sense, there will obviously be a learning curve, but that will be part of the role that Phil and I both play, ensuring that our head of schools are up to speed. And as I think you can see in the financial model, our model calls to hire that individual and have them placed within the community a year in advance of opening the school. And so we think that's really important because, as you know, having someone who's familiar with the local community and has the expertise of the local community, we think will give our school a distinct advantage in terms of being successful. That's not something we do because it makes a whole lot of financial sense, but we know it makes a ton of sense from in terms of the efficacy of the school and the ability to build relationships. So that individual, if the school was authorized, would move here in July or August and then be present in the community, conducting community meetings, meeting with parents, meeting with the local administration, meeting with local politicians, helping to make sure that the construction of the school, if it's a greenfield site or we have one renovation opportunity as well, is proceeding at the right pace, and essentially building that network of relationships across the community to ensure that the school is successful.
In both sections 1 and 2 of your application, you indicate there will be a corrective action process for head of schools, but there's little detail provided. Can you explain more what that process will entail and how will the board be involved?
Can I ask a clarifying question there? Is that about when the school is not achieving results, what the board is going to do in order to try to rectify that? Or is this about when the head of schools is not doing her or his job well? And
I'm sorry, Janine Johnson, Chief Human Resources Officer. We would be interested in looking at both performance and the not meeting goals, how you plan to work on a corrective action.
Sure. Well, I can speak of that from a principal perspective, of course. Generally speaking, there are expectations of principals that are either set at the state level, as far as like a rubric, or just the general practice of being an administrator. My general macro thought is that the position of administrator should always be, should be easily done, meaning if an administrator fails to do what he or she is supposed to be doing, they should be removed. I very strongly believe that. In fact, I think leadership is really important. So the systems that are set up have to be able to hold that person accountable to that. And in our case, we'd have a board that would have that same type of a rubric and expectation of our work. And some of that is just numbers. You know, how are the kids doing? How are they doing on tests? Are they actually learning how to read? Can they write? Can they do their math? Those types of things that we test. But there's obviously policy and ethical issues as well. Are they making decisions that are legal, ethical? And the rubrics that exist are around those same. And those rubrics are pretty consistent. I mean, just because we're a charter school and a classical school doesn't mean we don't want administrators that, you know what they're talking about administratively and know what the legal issues are and the policies. So there's an accountability that's always there. And I would be the first to suggest that if a person fails to do those things, then they should be removed. I mean, kids' lives are at stake, and it's really that important to us. A kid deserves the best, and it's not just the teacher that's in front of them. They deserve a leadership that is consistent with the values that we're trying to get kids to understand. So the systems around it are very much in place, and you're aware of it. I mean, I can tell you as a principal in one of these schools, I was in consistent conversation with the board, and it was very clear to me what the expectations were from the board and how I need to be acting to, in effect, stay employed there and serve kids. So, yeah, it's part of our work. I mean, I think our greatest accountability, frankly, is to a child. But if we're failing that child, there needs to be somebody that can correct us if need be.
I'll just add, there's clarity for the school leader about do they know what their role is and are they doing it? And there certainly, are they a good manager? And that's then a question for the board to be looking at. You've got annual reviews, you've got ongoing feedback. That school leader is coming to the board regularly reporting on results. And that's the second part, is what are the school's results for the children, as Phil was just alluding to. And that's a place where the board, as the strategic oversight body that's looking to the future, focused on kids' outcomes, and are we preparing them to flourish in their grown-up years or not? If those results are not there, then it's the board's job to be asking that school leader, what do you think are the causes of this? What are the corrective actions you're proposing so that we can have these kids be successful? And so there's questions about, is the curriculum right? Is something we're doing not right? Are there other factors that we can address? And then that's the place where then the board comes to understand too, does that school leader understand and be able to get the results if they're not getting them yet? And if not, then that also potentially becomes a cause for terminating the head of school.
Teacher recruitment has been a tremendous challenge for school systems across the nation, and we have certainly experienced similar challenges in recent years. What evidence do you have that you can be successful with recruiting teachers to your school in the current employment market?
I'll take a first crack at that, and then I can have Phil talk a little bit around the composition of makeup of the teachers within our school. So again, having had an extra year to be within the community and to be building relationships within the community, we have had a number of educators reach out and ask us when we will be hiring and provide their resumes. Obviously, that's not something we can share, but I think that number now in Clarksville, Montgomery, of folks who would like to move here or currently in Clarksville, Montgomery is north of 20. Obviously, we may not want to hire all those individuals, so that's no indication that that is a pool that we will fully exhaust. However, I think it's a good indication, given that we have not made any formal attempts or informal attempts to hire it. Well, this is all proactive folks who are reaching out to us about the school and about potential employment at the school. Of course, there is a distinct skill set that we're looking for in the schools in terms of our educators, and I can have Phil talk a little bit about that. But overall, we believe that most likely, if this is to be similar to other BCSI schools, there'll be sort of three tranches of educators who will join the school. The first tranche will be educators who are at retirement or near retirement or have retired. Obviously, you guys know that the law in Tennessee allows those folks to come in and not lose their pension. I've seen multiple resumes, for example, from folks who would fit that category. We think those educators are generally treasures, given the experience they have and the mentorship they can provide to younger educators within our school. So we'd be extremely excited to have them. They obviously won't be teaching for 25 years within the school, but they're an incredible asset that we bring in, and we expect generally one third of the educators would fit that mold. Another third is likely to be educators who are mid-career. This is more of a difficult jump for some, but we have found that there are educators who have left the profession for various reasons who would like to come back to the profession and would find the classical model to be very appealing. So those are sort of mid-tenured folks that would come into the school. And then the last third will likely be folks who are new to the teaching profession. We have both recruitment campaigns and the ability to reach out to local universities as well as universities across the state and nationally to find folks who would be interested in beginning their teaching careers in the classical education model. We have found that this to be sort of a very attractive value proposition. And to talk a little bit around how that works in practice, I'll let Phil talk for a minute.
The evidence I could provide would be from what I've done. So I started a BCSI school in Ohio. And frankly, while I was very aware of the teacher shortage, the place where it was evident to me was actually in the pools for substitute teachers. As far as actually attracting teachers to our work, it wasn't as difficult as one might think, and it's because of the things that Joel was saying. We have a unique model that attracts certain individuals to the work. And so some of these teachers that come into this work, it's the three pools that Joel was talking about. They find themselves being aligned to the vision of the school. And so they find themselves either reconsidering their retirement. So for example, one of those teachers that we had when she started with us in Ohio was 71. She was a retired Toledo Public School teacher, fantastic, one of the best teachers I've ever seen, and did all the things that Joel just said. Not only was she an exceptional teacher for a child, she was an exceptional teacher for young teachers to watch, and they did, and take her counsel. She was always dropping what I called pearls. She would say stuff, very humble woman, but she would say stuff and I'd just be like, that's awesome, and she'd be looking at me like, what? That what you just said was fantastic. So you have that pool, and then frankly you have people that come into our space from like private schools that may like what we're doing in the public realm. It's not our expectation obviously to take a bunch of teachers out of the public schools here, but you might have some that choose that they want this type of a vision. But that usually what makes it unique and what allows us to attract teachers is we are different. So when we say classical public charter school, and that's what we're trying to start, two of those words are unique. Most schools are not classical schools, and most schools aren't charter schools. And there are educators that's their niche. One of the things I talk about all the time is that teachers have to find their niche. Not all teachers are comfortable or relevant in all environments. And having worked in urban and rural and suburban spaces with different demographics of kids, one of the things that you find out as a teacher is you kind of have a niche. You have these super teachers that you can put anywhere, but those are rare. But this idea of there being a classical school, there are a lot of people that like classical schools, and there's a lot of people, this idea of a smaller charter school is attractive to them. So we attract people that a large district may not. Now, obviously, this would be new in Tennessee, so I can't speak forward with any evidence because I haven't had to go into the market as far as bringing teachers in. But I can tell you that the idea of classical and charter attract teachers. And we were always having a pretty good load of teachers to interview and consider for positions. And frankly, the teachers we had at my school were fantastic. I think over the first 3 years, we lost what, one teacher at the most per year. Just exceptional teachers. The retention rates are very high. So I understand the struggle, understand the largest struggle in the nation. I've watched it, saw it most in substitute teachers, but pulling the teachers to our schools was something that we were definitely able to do.
In reviewing your financials, there were some assumptions that were made. So rental costs, $12 per square foot, utilities, food services, $50,000 average teacher's salary, furniture costs. So all of these assumptions seemed low for our financial team, given the awareness of the costs locally and how much cash flow depends on the enrollment assumptions coming to fruition, as well as line items for things such as grants, parent fundraising, etc. So what contingencies do you have to ensure you can remain fiscally solvent?
I'll speak to both. The assumptions in the model currently are, let's call that our assumptions. However, based on the work we've done here locally, I think we feel quite confident in the ability to meet those assumptions, or at least be, you know, from a financial perspective, very close to those assumptions, such that it's not going to create a catastrophic effect on our financial budget. In particular, things like rent costs, utility costs, food service expenditures, and furniture costs, where we have a great deal of knowledge and expertise. I ran a furniture education company for a while, so I feel quite confident in the furniture numbers personally. In addition to that, in terms of remaining fiscally solvent, I think we're in a very unique position given the line of credit that's been extended to the school by the American Classical Education Foundation. That is a no interest, negotiable repayment term loan that will give the school more than enough financial solvency to really weather any storm that may come our way. Our goal, of course, and as you can see this in the model, is to not have to rely on that line of credit and to build a model that stands alone and is financially solvent without donations as a key component. There is a line item for donations here, but if you look at that in terms of the overall revenue, it's a minute fraction of the overall revenue. And that's because we want to make sure, while donations are great and fundraising will be a part of the school and should be a part of the school, that is not something that this model is predicated on or built on in order to be successful. And so in general, we feel quite good about our ability to, again, to weather any financial storm that may come our way. Based on our early, you know, assessment that we've done over the last year in terms of parent interest, we do not believe that there will be any problem filling this 340 seats we have. In fact, again, based on the latest numbers I was looking at, we would project a wait list of probably 2.5 times that within Clarksville Montgomery. And so given that we expect to have full enrollment, I think we'll be okay. Even if we did not achieve full enrollment for some reason, again, given that line of credit, we will be able to have many years under our belt where there would not be an issue to keep the school running at full capacity and with full services in order to meet the needs of the students and community.
Okay, last question. What MOUs or contracts have you secured for any services that can be provided at the funding level that you describe in your budget assumptions?
I don't have those right in front of me right now, but I know we have MOUs from our IT services provider. We have MOU from our financial services provider. We have initial MOUs. I don't think they're jointly signed from a food service provider here locally in Tennessee. Things like transportation, as we talked about earlier, are still TBD based on the needs of this, of the student community that chooses to enroll within the school. From a furniture perspective, I'm sure we could generate that if that would be something you guys would like to see. Again, we're pretty confident in these assumptions, given that they're built not only on our expertise, but also on the larger network of BCSI schools across the country, as well as the expertise of our financial services provider who helped us with this budget. And that entity, Prestige School Solutions, has worked with more than, I think, 120 charter schools around the country, and so has a pretty significant base of actuals to generate these assumptions.
All Right, and I think that concludes our question portion of this interview. Anything from the committee that we need to make sure we add?
This came up when adding the resources to the website. So the application, the official on the title page, it says American Classical Academy Montgomery. The official name though, American Classical Academy Clarkson Montgomery. And then throughout the application, it's both. So from a branding standpoint, have you all settled on which one it is, just so we make sure to reference correctly?
Yeah, I think our preference would be American Classical Academy, Clarksville, Montgomery, to mimic the local nomenclature that you guys use to describe the school system and to make it clear to folks who potentially enrolling that it's inclusive of the entire CMCSS community. And I think that was the simplest question we got. So.
All right, I think that concludes our section, and we thank you so much for traveling in and look forward to next steps.
Thank you so much for having us.